KOLL.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Today we're going to talk about the border dispute, and we're going to give a local angle to that border dispute. There was recently a protest in Tampa that we want to talk about first, and later on we're going to hear what Elizabeth Warren said when she announced that she is forming an exploratory committee to run for president. Well, as NPR and WMNF have been reporting, and many other news outlets have been reporting all day, in Southern California, U.S. authorities fired tear gas into Mexico yesterday during the first hours of the new year to repel about 150 migrants who are trying to cross the border fence in Tijuana. Here's a report from the Associated Press.
In an incident along the U.S.-Mexico border at Tijuana early Tuesday, U.S. Customs and Border Protection says tear gas was fired to repel about 150 migrants who tried to breach the border fence. According to the statement, the gas was used specifically against rock throwers who were apart from the migrants who were trying to cross, and that no agents witnessed any of the migrants at the fence, including children, experiencing effects of the chemical agents. However, an Associated Press photographer saw at least three volleys of gas that affected migrants, including women and children, as well as journalists. The AP saw rocks thrown after the agents fired the tear gas. I'm Mike Rossia.
All right, that was Tijuana, Mexico, and the southern border of California yesterday. Mike Rossia did that report. We're going to talk about something, a local angle on that right now. We're joined by two activists who are with the Border Patrol Victims Network. They took part in a protest in Ybor City outside the U.S. Customs Office. And we're joined by Desiree Lynn and Anna Maria Vasquez. Thank you both, Desiree and Anna Maria, for coming by WMNF. Great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Great to see you.
So this protest that you were involved in took place the day after Christmas. And Anna Maria, why were you out there protesting? What were you concerned about?
Well, the idea of the Border Patrol Victims Network is to join with a lot of the families who have been killed by Border Patrol. So it was a vigil in a way that we were calling the names of those who have been killed by the Border Patrol.
How many people have been killed by the U.S. Border Patrol?
103 people, 97 on the U.S. and 6 on the Mexican side that we know. So we don't know how many, besides the hundreds that have died.
So that would be a minimum number.
A number that we know. Yeah, there are probably more, but these are the ones that are known.
6 people died on the Mexican side?
Have been shot on the Mexican side.
By U.S. agents?
By U.S. agents. And that's why we were there in Ybor City, because we've been kind of pushing and helping and supporting the family of Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, who was shot 10 times in the back by Lonnie Schwartz, a Border Patrol agent, in Nogales, Mexico, while he was walking home. It was a very clear case of excessive use of force. It was 10 o'clock at night. The Border Patrol was up on a hill behind a metal fence. There was no way that Jose Antonio presented a threat to him.
Jose Antonio was in Mexico.
He was in Mexico. Even the border agent, the ex-border agent, he wrote a very good article, which you can look on our Facebook page, Border Patrol Victims Network. And he says that in his 21 years of working as a Border Patrol, he never felt threatened by anybody on the other side. And it was an obvious excessive use of force. The person, Tom Shellack, who was in charge of Border Patrol at that time, saw the video, which then got lost, and also said that this was excessive use of force. Two trials went, and on both, he was acquitted. In the last one, even of involuntary manslaughter.
When did the shooting first take place?
It took place in 2012.
When did the two trials take place?
It took 4 years to get the name of the Border Patrol agent, and the first trial was 2016, and then the last trial was ended in December this year.
What was the young man doing at 10 o'clock at night?
He was 4 blocks from his house. He was walking to see his brother and to go to his house. And he shot him.
He wasn't trying to cross
the border. He was shot. He tried to stand up. The guy reloaded the gun 3 times and shot from different angles.
And the Border Patrol agent was put on trial and found not guilty twice?
Twice. And now the case is going to go to the... Of course, the prosecution did not... do a good job, and it's of course the government defending the government.
What possible justification would there be for firing from the U.S. into Mexico?
There is no justification. This is what is very frightening. This was an opportunity to bring justice to one case, which would open up many other cases, and instead of that, by acquitting this guy, we open up the possibility of horrors to come. Because if this is legal, then you know anybody on the border now can be killed. And they say that when the bullet leaves the United States, they don't know. And this case and another case of a 15-year-old shot in Juarez are going to go back to the Supreme Court. One court case went already to see if the family had a right to seek justice, you know, to do a civil case. And they couldn't decide. But now it's going to go back. And with the way they're making the border such a, like a terror area, we are very worried that the Supreme Court will not make a right decision, and this would put everybody who lives on the border under very big danger.
Desiree, I think it's fair to say that a lot of Americans don't know this is going on, that 6 Mexican civilians have been shot by U.S. Border Patrol agents, and there have been other shootings, too, by U.S. border agents of people trying to cross the border. I think this story is largely untold.
It is. And then also, aside from the violence that's happening at the border, you have violence against immigrants that are in detention centers here in the U.S. who absolutely pose no threat. There's been over 1,000 instances of people that have reported sexual violence and rape against them by ICE officials and ICE police inside of the detention centers. And these are just the ones that are being reported. There was a lot of people that overseeing agencies that had gone into just a small percentage of these immigration detention centers and had seen that the smallest of protections, like having a list of their rights, you know, visible for them, weren't even posted. So it's violence at the border, killings at the border, and the, you know, reaffirmed impunity by the acquittals of Lonnie Schwartz. But then also there's border agents inside of this country attached to ICE that are committing crimes literally on a daily basis, that the headlines are coming and going and they're so prolific, and that narrative is really not taking
foothold. How do you know that?
So I'm with Occupy ICE Tampa, and one of the things we did to get to the public these crimes that are happening is a document about our movement and about our assertion that freedom of movement is not a criminal act, and that seeking asylum is not a criminal act, being an immigrant is not a criminal act. We put out a document detailing these crimes, detailing the sexual violence happening inside of immigration detention center, detailing the violence at the border, and detailing the toxic socio-political rhetoric that's coming out of the White House.
So you name names, you name dates, you name places, you've got testimony, I guess people have given testimony somewhere?
They have, but also we don't, survivors, we don't blast their information out, so we don't, because we understand that there's, like I said, the violent socio-political rhetoric that's going on, criminalizing immigrants. We don't want to further put survivors at risk, but we're letting people know that these issues are happening, you know, these things are happening on a daily basis, and exactly what Anna Maria said, when impunity is reaffirmed, and they're allowed to have immunity at gunning down a young person across borders, and that goes completely, you know, with zero accountability, that, you know, of course these kind of crimes are going to continue inside of the U.S. and then it's just join hands with the narrative that, you know, people are, you know, like the rape survivor would have, you know, been okay if she hadn't dressed so provocatively. The person crossing the border would have been, you know, all these excuses that legitimize violence against immigration.
Well, we're talking with two members of the Border Patrol Victims Network. Desiree Lynn is here and Anna Maria Vasquez, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So Anna Maria and Desiree, you were down in Ybor City the day after Christmas. You're protesting outside the the customs office, the Border Patrol office that's right there on 7th Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's in the heart of Ybor City in the district. There's lots of people walking up and down the street, having a good time the day after Christmas. Anna Maria, I want to ask you about the other five people. Were these all civilians who were shot by U.S. Border Patrol Mexico?
There was Sergio Adrián, who was 15 years old, who was just sitting under the bridge in Ciudad Juárez. And you can look at a video because there's a video of him. There's also...
In right across the border from Texas?
In Ciudad Juárez.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And then in Matamoros, it was Guillermo Arevalo Pedrosa, who was shot while he was in a picnic with his wife and his two daughters. And there's Ramses Barón, who was shot also in Nogales. The thing, a lot of these cases you don't hear, because like Ramses Barón was raised in an orphanage, so there was nobody to follow up. The family of José Antonio are real heroes. They follow through this. You know, right now, there's the case these cases of the Mexican shootings are terrible, but I'm just thinking that on that date in Tampa also, just a child had been died under Border Patrol care, and two children, Jacqueline and Felipe, 8 and 7 year olds. I'm thinking these Border Patrols who've been killing the people in Mexico and on the U.S. side are now in charge of children? I mean, they're supposed to be taking care of these kids, because they, by not being charged, a lot of them are still working there. They are still Border Patrol.
Just getting back to the six people in Mexico who were shot by U.S. agents who were standing on the American side.
Yes.
Has the Mexican government objected to the shootings?
I think in the case of Sergio Adrián at that time, they tried to ask for extradition, and but they didn't follow. The Mexican government was not really, you know, they wanted to be in good terms with the U.S. government. Hopefully now, with López Obrador, we have hopes that the Mexican government will stand against, you know, and make an official protest about these killings and do something about it.
The families have to be devastated in Mexico.
Not only devastated, but they have to follow these laws. I mean, I was really broken when I saw the trial of José Antonio, because the lawyers were saying awful things about the family of José Antonio, like, oh, they are like drug dealers and all. And the grandmother and the mother, the grandmother said, I wouldn't be cleaning houses. She lives in Nogales, Arizona. And she said, I wouldn't be cleaning houses in the United States, living in a trailer, if I was a drug dealer. But they always try to portray the people like monsters. And the case of Guillermo Arevalo Pedrosa, the family was on a picnic. And nothing has happened with that case.
So these are just six people not trying to cross the border, but they're shot and killed. And how do we know that all six were shot by U.S. Border Patrol agents or, officials of the U.S.
government? Can look on the Southern Border Coalition webpage, because you can see a lot of the cases. And Sergio Adrián, you see the guy coming down from his bicycle shooting. There were kids running, touching the border fence. This is during the day. And he just comes down and shoots him. His mom is like so broken. It's like it happened yesterday. She doesn't have so much support as the family of José Antonio. José Antonio's video is lost. Guillermo Arevalo Pedrosa, they were witnesses. I mean, they're witness to these cases. These are not cases that
the video was lost because it's U.S. government video? Is that?
Yes, it's a U.S. government video.
So somehow the U.S. government, its own official surveillance video is missing somehow.
Yes, missing, yes.
When it shows the actual shooting.
Uh-huh. But, you know, you see the case of Sergio Adrián, you can see the shooting. And, you know, there's the case of Anastasio Hernandez, who was kicked by 11 Border Patrol. He was on the U.S. side, but there's a video of him being kicked by 11 Border Patrol. He died.
Desiree, what do you think the best approach is for Americans who want to see justice and not see civilians and people who are innocent killed along the U.S. border with Mexico? What's the best thing that people can do?
Well, I wouldn't name the best thing. I would think a variety of things. I think people staying active and vocal and visible and using every tool in our toolbox to amplify the voices of survivors, to amplify the voices of the people that are seeking asylum and trying to do what anyone else would do if their family was in a dangerous situation, and try to get somewhere safe. So I would say remaining vigilant in getting getting not only the survivors' voices, but the names of the people that have committed these horrendous crimes, like Lonnie Schwartz, against unarmed refugees, and constantly challenging. I'm not going to attach it to one president. I mean, this, you know, mass roundups and deportations have been happening on both sides of the, you know, political lines. So I think continuing to challenge, and then that's what we were trying to do outside the Customs and Border Patrol office. And one of the stratagems there, and as well as us camping outside of the ICE offices, is to take these businesses out of this faux respectability that they think they possess by not, you know, the Customs and Border Patrol office in Ybor, you wouldn't even know that it was a Border Patrol office. It has no sign on it. They try, and it's asserted through the development companies like Birchwood, that they're trying to melt in with the business surroundings, and they're trying to be nondescript. So dragging them out of that faux respectability of, you know, there's some ambiguous business, and making it visible what they are, who they are, and what they're doing, and how they're funded, and continuing that, and just using, like I said, all the tools in our toolboxes was what people can continue to do to make this, you know, this narrative last and have teeth, you know.
Anne Marie, a week ago last Wednesday, you were in Ybor City along with Desiree and about a dozen other people. Maybe it got bigger. I was there for a few minutes, and it looked like there were about 12 people. You were protesting outside the customs office. And as I saw it, you had a megaphone, and you were shouting into the direction of the office. It was peaceful, but then I understand that there was an altercation later on. Tell us what happened last Wednesday in Ybor City.
Okay, what happened, we were trying also to get into the heads of the Border Patrol organization, their agency, that they themselves need to seek justice inside their organization. Because we have been trying, doing all these things.
Want them to get a conscience.
Yes.
You want them to have a conscience about human beings.
Not have to be ashamed to work with there. I mean, I want them to seek justice inside their office themselves. You know, we are doing it outside. And then these very courageous, wonderful people, Desiree and the group, the Occupy ICE and the Love Has No Borders, they came in and made a wall, like a border wall, in the middle of the street. Just, you know, to show how it feels to all of a sudden not be able to go from one side to
another.
You
were trying to mimic what happened on the southern U.S. border?
Exactly. And it was a wonderful statement. And there was police there. But then the traffic that was going through, you know, some people. But there was this guy who was trying to, not only the guy on the white van trying to run over, there was another guy on a green car. And they both continued to push themselves against the people. I had never seen this. I was like, oh. What's going to happen? And then the police was standing on the other side. I was talking on the microphone. I was saying, this is a very small inconvenience, you know, to just turn around. Imagine what the people have to go through. Think about the families who have just lost their children in care of the Border Patrol. Think about the people who have been shot by Border Patrol. This is nothing. Just, you know, this is a reminder that we need to speak up. These people standing on the line there, these are our heroes. But the police was doing nothing on that side. I was just glad they didn't shoot anybody. You know, because when you come from the border, you worry about things
so,
like this.
So did the vehicles, you were blocking the street in front of the customs office. Did the vehicles touch any of your protest group?
Yes. Yes, both the van and the green car that were coming from two different directions rolled into the legs of protesters. And from my point of view, I can't speak to the car behind me and the people behind me, but the vehicle, the white van that was in front of us, stated that he was going to roll into us and then continue to do so in front of police who did nothing. And I think that highlights, you know, police complicity and what, you know, just allowing criminality against people that are making statements about justice for people that are marginalized in this country and others.
I observed about 8 Tampa police officers there observing your group, your protest group. So they saw the green car and the white truck or van run into the group, members of your group.
Yes, and not only that, but the person in the van said to us, because he mentioned it before I even saw, in front of the police, I'm going to run into you. That is exactly what he said.
Was anybody injured?
People's legs were just what you would expect from a car rolling into people. Luckily, no one was seriously injured. But what we did was enact essentially a border in front of Customs and Border Patrol. They wanted a wall. We enacted a wall there. The nuance there is that we would have moved if someone was injured, if there was an ambulance, a fire truck, something that was trying to get through. But we possess nuance. Border walls and fences don't possess any nuance. They stop freedom of movement and stop people that are fleeing tragic situations. So, yeah, this van was allowed by Tampa Police to hit us. We have the video we've shown you. They allowed that, and then they told us, we are going to pull them over as soon as you let them through. We didn't let them through. They allowed them to leave the scene without a question, without seeing if they were intoxicated, anything.
Did the police ask whether or not members of your group were injured by these automobiles and trucks?
They did not, although one of the people that was hit was stating again and again, I was hurt, this person hit me, I want them pulled over, I want to file a police report, and the police said, we'll stop them as soon as they get past, we'll stop them, and they just let them go right through without so much as a question. And very quickly, a week before this, outside of a Walmart, a police like held people that were unarmed down on the ground at gunpoint screaming and arrested them for shoplifting, yet defending capital, but defending life and defending, you know, the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, they allowed a car to roll into us and leave the scene.
Oh, this was at the Walmart in Tampa?
In Hillsborough.
Hillsborough.
On Hillsborough Avenue.
Hillsborough Avenue, mm-hmm. Eastern Hillsborough Avenue. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about what happened last Wednesday in Ybor City when a group of people who were protesting the Border Patrol and ICE protested outside the Customs and Border Patrol office in Ybor City. And this is WMNF in Tampa. If you've got an email question, you can email it in to us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org, or you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Desiree Lynn is here. She's with Occupy ICE, and Anna Maria Vasquez is with the Border Patrol Victims Network. Can people see this video online? Have you posted it online? Or
we have not. We're waiting for the person who took the video to consent. As you know, and as a lot of people know, the police, you know, they're not, like, in real time going to be on the side of the people that, you know, are making political statements and you know, upending the basic social order of what's happening in any given day. So if they're, you know, if there's video with protesters in it that are blocking a street, chances are that they're going to go after the people that were in the street rather than the people themselves, as they did right there in real time. So we're considering whether to release that video or not.
Anna Maria, I saw a reporter from a local TV station there who covered part of the protest. Did this incident with the truck running into the demonstrators, did that show up on TV that night?
No. He was the person that the two TV stations didn't stay long enough, I think, to report anything. That we put on the Border Patrol Victims Network some pictures of the people blocking, and, you know, you can see the van and you can see the things like this. And I'm just thinking that it's ironic because the only person who got arrested in the Lonnie Schwartz trial was one of our volunteers, Richard Boren. He was arrested because he stood up in court and called out the travesty of law that this trial was. So this is something like this. Instead of, you know, going after the people who are the criminals, the police have become complacent and it just allows things to happen. And allowing things to happen when you can do something about it is very dangerous.
And just checking, in what city did that trial take place?
It took place in Tucson.
In Tucson. Let's take a call or two. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and we're talking about a protest that happened a week ago in Ybor City. And let's take take one or two phone calls. Let's go to Tony, who's in Tampa. Tony, what's your question for our guests?
Well, I mean, I'm a half Cuban. My father moved here from Cuba in 1959. It wasn't a wet foot, dry foot policy or anything like that. But I hate to say it, but I really believe that probably 75-80% of Americans have a major issue with anybody that crosses the border illegally, and even the protesting that you're doing. I know you're trying to bring light to a difficult issue. If you're standing in a right of way and you're obstructing somebody's ability to go to work, you've already done the first wrong thing. And I hate to say it, the police aren't going to jump in and arrest somebody. They'll say, "Hey, listen, I was trying to go and do my I'm a nun and I work down the street, or I'm a doctor, or I'm a nurse, or I'm a guy going to a job at 7-Eleven, and these people won't let me make a living." You're not going to get any empathy or sympathy from the vast majority majority of Americans.
Tony, I want to let Desiree and Anna Maria answer that question, but let me ask you just real quickly. Hundreds of thousands of people came here from Cuba, essentially let in and given benefits. The Mariel Boatlift being a big example in 1980, your dad, 1959. A lot of people who come here from Cuba are given lots of benefits that Mexicans and Hondurans and Guatemalans don't get. Do you think that that was wrong for the country to do that?
Number one, my dad came over here with my uncle who had an established business, and he had to go through the whole, I'm bringing him over, I've got a job for him. This is 59 now, okay? And it was, I'll give him a job, and he'll never be a burden on the U.S. government.
The overall policy for most of the last 50 years is to allow people automatically to come here from Cuba and to also give them benefits that Mexicans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, Salvadorans don't get. What do you think about that policy?
Oh, I didn't like it, but the fact is it was actually a law.
Yeah, it's a policy.
Correct. It's a policy. I mean, I can tell you. I mean, I make Ronald Reagan look like a communist when it comes to conservative views. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's see what
I never liked that left foot right foot deal.
All right, Tony. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks. All right. So, Anna Maria and Desiree, what would you say to Tony?
I say to Tony that I don't think 75% of the United States people are thinking like this, and I think that he should come to the border. I think that the people who were there in Ybor City, they were not in an emergency like the zero was saying. It was a very peaceful blocking, and most people just went and turned around and went back about their business. And I was talking to them, you know, it was just a way to make a statement.
For how many minutes did you block traffic?
I would say 10 minutes or something like this.
Yeah, something like that. But I want to thank you so much for asking that and bringing up that point, because that's so valuable. You ask why we're imposing on traffic and things like this, and I'm asking you why this country is imposing on people that are escaping. You know, they're not late for work. Their families are very likely in a terrible situation. Either they're fleeing war, they're fleeing violence of gangs, they're fleeing extreme poverty, environmental racism. They're fleeing things that a lot of issues that U.S. intervention and U.S. tampering have helped to exacerbate. So while you ask me why we were stopping people from going to work, I ask you why we're stopping people from getting somewhere safe so that their families have a chance at life, like your grandfather did and like other people from other places have come to. The fact is, when you decontextualize something and you say, oh, they can just apply for asylum, well, the caravan came here applying for asylum. And what they were met with was a lot of rhetoric that has made something that's going to be a huge backlog even longer because of poisoned public opinion against them.
Let's take another phone call. Tony, thanks a lot for your phone call, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. And let's go to Andrew, who's in Tampa. Hi, Andrew. You're on. What's your question?
Yeah, hey, actually, I had two things to stress. One is the impeding on traffic thing that Tony brought up. There are countless demonstrations that have been done, and you can look online, you can see them, not just by issues with Latino rights, but people disagreeing with LGBT or whatever may be protesting in the street. And there are many, many, many occasions where cars are just running into them, driving them over. And again, the police will do nothing because there is no sympathy, no empathy for people who are standing in the middle of the road. That's not where they're supposed to be. You deciding to break a law on your own to impede on what people are doing, exactly what Tony said, going to work, going to their families, you're not going to get sympathy from the police, and you're not going to get sympathy from the majority of Americans. That's just simply the way it is. It's stupid decisions deserve stupid results, and that's really what that is. You don't stay in the middle of the road. But again, what she just said about these people who are fleeing, the reason why there's a negative rhetoric on these people who are fleeing the country is people are fleeing Mexico or Guatemala or wherever they're trying to come from South America, is that when the statistics that are looked at between crime rates, between illegal immigrants who are coming to the country, and the amount of illegals who are coming here looking for handouts and skipping the line in front of tens of thousands of people from other countries, from Europe, from Asia, who are wanting to also come to the United States, who are going through the process correctly, filling out the paperwork they're supposed to do, and waiting their turn. It's like they're wanting an extra I don't know if they're wanting special treatment because...
Andrew, let me ask you a quick question. Where can you prove to me that people that come here without documents are given handouts?
Sure.
Where can you prove
sure.
to me?
So,
yeah.
so much as, let's say, the state of Arizona. If you look at Arizona, the amount of crime rate that's done by illegal immigrants in Arizona alone is up to 46%. And this isn't just theft.
Now, where do you get that statistic? Because Ana Maria lived in Arizona. But, Andrew, where do you get that statistic? Because I'm going to look that up right now. And if you're wrong, I think you're doing a disservice to your cause. So where do you get that statistic?
You can find that on any...
You're saying that the crime rate among illegal immigrants is higher than people that live here, who live here with the proper documents?
In Arizona alone.
All right. I'm going to look that up, Andrew, and I'm going to find out right now. So don't turn off your radio, okay?
Sure. No problem.
All right. Thanks a lot. Do you think Andrew's right? Desiree, is Andrew right?
Absolutely not. But I also want to thank you, Andrew, for furthering my point that the people that are on the other end of this issue who do not constitute 75% of the population of this country. There was a tweet that provided a really good summation for this kind of sentiment. When people who are wealthy and privileged demand respect in life, it's civil. But when people who are marginalized and terrorized and not on the privileged end of socio, political benefit, they're terroristic, they're breaking the law, they're stopping traffic, they're interrupting Sarah Sanders' meal with her family. Why does one take precedent and the other doesn't? People are allowing themselves to, I don't know, either knowingly or unknowingly express racist, xenophobic rhetoric that they're repeating straight out of Donald Trump's mouth and straight out of people that support that line of all immigration being criminal coming from South and Central America. And the fact is that it's not. We've criminalized people before, and this is just, another group that we're criminalizing for immigration while it's allowed for other people. That statistic is absolutely not true. And the fact that he can't cite a source of where he got it from just backs it up, saying 46% of the crime in Arizona comes from undocumented persons is absolutely false.
Well, I did look it up, and I found where he got it. It's one study by a guy named Lott, John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. But that study looked at data beginning in 1985 and going to June 2017. But it is highly disputed. And my source on this is factcheck.org. And factcheck.org, I'm not going to read the whole thing, just one paragraph. Factcheck says, as we said, there aren't readily available nationwide crime statistics broken down by immigration status, but the available research that estimates the relationship between illegal immigration and crime generally shows an association with lower crime rates for undocumented immigrants. And that's what factcheck.org says. That's my source. Anybody that wants it, I will email it to you. But there's dozens of fact checks about whether or not undocumented immigrants commit a higher crime rate. And and most of those that I just surveyed as we were sitting here show that undocumented immigrants have a lower crime rate than people that live here. And I will be happy to share that with Andrew. Andrew, if you email me at dj@wmnf.org. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's maybe take one or two more phone calls. Let's see who's been holding the longest. Hugh in Tampa has been holding for a while. Hugh, what's your question?
Hi, yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I have 2 points. The first thing I'd like to say quickly is that I recently viewed a PBS video called 500 Nations, and it talked about two of the original conquerors. One was Christopher Columbus, and the other one was a General DeSoto. And in hearing what your guest has been talking about, people with privilege, DeSoto, especially when he went around the Dominican Republic and down in South America where he first landed, the only thing he could find that was of any value was the gold that they had down there. And so he enslaved a lot of the people down there, made them feed his soldiers and troops because they had no way, they came over on boats. They had no way of feeding themselves. But for years and years, decades, enslaved the people down there. And I'm wondering if that still today, I mean, we celebrate Christopher Columbus Day. If that still isn't, you know, part of the reason why people turn such a blind eye towards the suffering down there of the indigent people that were, you know, originally born there.
All right, Hugh, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call.
I think you are very right. You know, this is to question what is happening with the border right now is to question how this country and all of the countries in the continent started. And this is why right now the nations, the original nations of the continent, decided to give our continent the name of Abya Yala. From Alaska to the land of fire, we are one people. We recognize rivers and mountains, lakes and deserts and swamps, but we do not recognize any borders. This is a truth that any living being can show, except for humans, because you can see the birds flying across the borders. You can see the animals going through and out of the fence, the ones that can, of course. And we breathe the same air, we drink the same water, we nourish from the same earth. And this is what is common, that holds us common. And this is what we need to strengthen, because if we continue to strengthen this separation that colonization made to exploit, to make slaves of our peoples all over, then we will never be free in this continent.
If the indigenous people were here first, what percent of those folks that are coming up from Honduras would you say are indigenous people?
Most people coming from Honduras, a lot of the people coming from all over this continent, a lot of people, because of course they were the most exploited and still are. So the poorest people are the ones who are coming, trying to get across the borders. The ones who are like the drug dealers and all these guys come on airplanes. They have, you know, passports and everything. They live in the United States.
Let me just say that my offer of sending the fact check, which I have come up with a number of places that show that undocumented immigrants commit crimes at fewer rates than people that live here already, that offer still stands. You can email me here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org if you want to link to some of these sites.
No, and you risk deportation when you are illegal here, so you really watch out. You know, you are afraid even to make a traffic, error, because that caused deportation. So I would say that illegal people here are the most cautious.
I'm so sorry. A lot of the headlines that are coming out, actually pretty much 100% of the headlines that are coming out are not, undocumented person has committed this violent crime. It's that a father that's been here for 30 years that has five children was followed to work and arrested, or that a person that came, like, I don't know how many people, it was 70 or 100 or maybe up to 170 people that had come forward to adopt some of the migrant children that were being held by the state. That was used as a trap. So they were using these children as bait to get undocumented persons and get them, and even people that were to deport them. So these headlines that are coming out day after day after day after day of people that have families here, that have built lives, that are contributing, that are working, that are our neighbors, that are in our community, that comprise, you know, our cities and different, you know, they're being, you know, trapped, they're being followed, they're being picked up while they're dropping their children off at school. They're not being picked up while they're, for instance, on a mass shooting, this is the reality of it.
Adam writes this. He said, of course people don't like blocking traffic. That's the point. Martin Luther King was called a terrorist. Do you think he cared? You can't make change when people are comfortable, writes Adam. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. And we're talking about immigration. Let's go to John in St. Pete. John, you're on. What's your question?
Morning, Rob. Thanks for having your guests on there. These people that were calling in saying, you know, you need to get out of traffic because we're on our way to work. You know, we should run you over. Nobody cares. How do you think change happens? How do you think Martin Luther King got people sat at the lunch counter and got beat up and disrupted somebody else's lunch? How do you think change happens? And as far as calling them illegals, they're undocumented. There's no crime against seeking asylum in the United States. And mm-hmm. How many dictators we prop up in Honduras and Guatemala and taught mm-hmm. them torture techniques, intervened in their governments, overthrew governments, duly elected democratic governments, and put in dictators. You know, we have a big responsibility to these people, and they're human beings.
What's wrong with these people? That 35% of the country is Trump. They hate these immigrants. Okay, but the rest of us don't. We accept them as human beings that are seeking asylum. What is wrong with that? I don't get it.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
This is 88.5 FM. Let's go to Eric in Newport Richey. Hi, Eric. You're on. What's your question?
Hi. While I was waiting, it seemed like a lot of people brought up a lot of the points I wanted to make, in fact, which was, you know, I heard a few callers say that most people don't want people coming across the southern border. And I mean, I saw a statistic that said that 58% of the country opposes the border wall. And even of the, 42% that do, most of them don't think it should be a priority. And, you know, I personally, you have to look at the reasons people are coming here, and a lot of Mexican immigrants come here because they have family here. I mean, a lot of the land that we claim is United States territory now was part of Mexico. So, you know, you've got families that have lived separate for a century now, more than a century now. And so the fact that people want to move freely across that border seems pretty natural to me. I think, honestly, we should have an open border agreement with Mexico. But that's just my opinion.
All right, Eric, thanks. Thanks for your opinion. Lots of people are weighing in. Anna Maria or Desiree, do you want to add to anything you've heard here so far?
Well, I wanted to say that it used to be an open border for a very long time. And I know a lot of people who lived in the United States and in Mexico, people of U.S., you know, like origin coming from Europe or whatever, who spoke Spanish perfectly because they used to go to Navojoa with the cowboys to bring the cows and the other way around. And, you know, during Christmas, people went each to their own country and did their own thing. And the border was like that always. It is only lately that it has become such a big problem.
This email came in from Five Havens. Five writes, Trump wants $5 billion for the wall as vital for national security. We already spend $700 billion for national security and are running an $800 billion deficit. He or she writes, no more debt for more security. Trump needs to shift a very small piece of the already bloated security budget if that wall is so important. Prioritize, not just blindly spend more borrowed money, writes Five. And somebody from the 813 area code disagrees with our caller, Andrew. He uses much harsher words. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, words that I can't say on the radio. Thanks a lot for that. Let's go back to Ron and Sefner. Ron, you're on. What's your comment?
Hey, Rob, how you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in here, and to your guests, kudos to them. They're very expressive of the viewpoint, and I think they're very accurate. I'm not taking anything away from anybody else, but I noticed something a while back when this whole thing started, Rob. You remember we had an unemployment epidemic, and then all of a sudden they start deporting all the, Spanish people in different cultures, and then all of a sudden our employment numbers went up and or down, I'd say, and that was a dilemma, and I think most people are overlooking that and just jumping to the easiest thing to do, and that's say that these people caused us harm, these people took our jobs, these people did that, but when they brought them in or they allowed them to come in the first place, nobody had that concern because they was exploiting them, using for cheap labor, and all of this, and I live out in Sefner, and I used to observe the people, you know, mostly Hispanics, and they don't bother anybody or say anything to you. I've asked them, you know, questions, and they say don't speak English. So I'd be like, okay, well, you know, that's cool. I ain't bothering you. And they work, and I learned that people was robbing them, Rob. They was taking their money because they was illegal or whatever, and they'd work hard, and the people would rob them for money. So they've been exploiting them all along. And then when they deported them, they took all of their property, their money, and their economics. They didn't send that with them back across the border, okay? So this whole thing ain't nothing but exploitation, and I don't think it should be going nobody's way like that. I think it should be for the people and all the people concerned. We all immigrants. We all came from other places. So I don't agree with none of those people who point the finger. And then when you say block the roads, they was blocking my road today over here cutting trees. There was no police. There was two trucks or three trucks, and there was just people that worked for a company. They blocked the road, and we had to go around. We didn't run over them. We didn't do any of that ignorance. So, when I hear ignorance like that, I like to call in because that's what's causing us problems, you know what I mean?
All right, Ron. Ron, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you.
Fully agree. Thank you so much. That's such an important point. There's a strong lack of nuance. And also one thing that I want to bring up that you brought up to me is that, another dynamic of this is that mixed status couples have been that are in an abusive relationship. There's been reports of threatening, I'll turn you into border patrol. Another trans person that was undocumented went to file a court statement of protection against someone who was physically abusing her and was arrested and deported. People are afraid to come forward and talk about crimes being committed against them because they're afraid that they're going to be deported, mm-hmm. which is the very valid and legitimate fear. That's the things that it's doing is it's putting people in dangerous situations and keeping them there. They're entrenching them in dangerous situations because they can't come forward. People that would come forward and be witnesses again for car accidents, witnesses for violent crimes that have happened, witnesses for some violence that have happened. They can't. They're afraid and they're being silenced because of this, that their hands are tied. And then one other quick thing I wanted to bring up is that I do a lot of work as far as mutual aid with disaster relief and people that, and because we're in Florida, when Hurricane Irma happened, people left Florida and went to find safe spaces with their families. You are, in fact, a climate refugee that has been displaced, albeit temporarily and maybe permanently, depending on the damage you sustained because of a climate catastrophe. And there was no border set up on Florida telling you that you could not get somewhere safe. So just think about that. We have freedom of movement, and denying it to other people who are in dangerous situations is wrong, the same way that it would be wrong if someone told you had to stay in your house with a violent storm that was a threat to your life was coming.
Well, we're talking about the U.S. border, and we're talking with two activists who last Wednesday conducted a peaceful protest in Ybor City. For most of the protest, they were standing on the sidewalk but according to them, for about 10 minutes, they blocked traffic at Ybor City. And we're talking about why they blocked traffic, why they protested outside the customs office. And our guests are Anna Maria Vasquez and Desiree Lynn. And they're both affiliated with the Border Patrol Victims Network. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Robert writes this, I live near the stadium and traffic is impeded for hours every time there's a game. And the police help with that. Somehow that's okay. But for someone to call attention to a human rights issue and be endangered is not okay? Writes Robert. Robert, thank you for your email. And I got to say that our friend Andrew, who called up, who said that undocumented immigrants in Arizona can commit higher crime rates, has not emailed me and asked for those statistics that I offered to provide him. Well, this is WMNF. Let's go to Joanne. Hi, Joanne, you're on. What's your question?
Hi, I have several questions. My mom immigrated from the Caribbean legally. My grandmother's She's very poor, and she worked selling food until she was able to purchase visas for all of her children from a British country into the U.S. And so I wanted to find out, what were their thoughts? What are the barriers that they have to apply legally? And some of the problems that we've had, as far as with Cuba, someone mentioned that earlier, there are a lot of people from Haiti that they're fleeing from persecution, and they're sent right back. They don't have the same type of policies for Haiti as they have for Cuba. And I want to know, why do the people in South America feel that their country are more deserving of just, getting entry than any other country, if they feel that way? And I heard her spoke about illegal entry, illegal activity of the Border Patrol, which is always bad. No one wants to promote any bad activity, but the people are also trying to enter illegally. So how do they think about being against illegal activity, but when the people are trying to enter illegally, how do they feel about that? And what are the barriers to correcting the problems at the countries that they're having that are making the people come from the countries? what can be done to fix their country so that people can stay in their homeland.
All right. Well, Joanne, there's a lot of questions there, and we only have a few minutes left. So let's try to whittle some of those down. Joanne, thanks a lot. First of all, why not just come apply for entry into the U.S.?
Okay.
Anna Marie, what would you say?
To apply for a regular visa, it costs $200, and most people are denied the visa. Even if you have all the papers, even if you have the bank accounts and all this, you have to have money to be able to get a visa. But even if you have money, not necessarily you'll get the visa. And then when you are crossing to seek refuge, I'm from Colombia. And in Colombia, we have already received more than 1 million people from Venezuela because the people are fleeing and there's nobody's like stopping them. Stay in Venezuela until we define your situation. And when you're seeking refuge, you don't have anything. So now you have people on the border from Guatemala who have come all the way up and now they have to wait in Mexico so that they can apply for asylum. That is completely illegal and it's very hard. It's cold right now and it's a very dangerous situation to be waiting when you have nothing. Thank goodness that people have been helpful, you know, and have helped, you know, to feed the people. But this is not the way you do for asylum seeker. You let the people in, you do the application for asylum, and you decide yes or no. You don't hang on to people. Like they're allowing people to come in, they put a bracelet on their foot, okay, make them slaves because that's how it is. Nobody's caring for anybody. And whenever they want, they can deport them. And this is even worse than how things were. So there is no legal recourse for people to ask even for a visa or even for asylum.
Desiree, let me ask you the question that Joanne asked. What can be done in countries like Honduras, Salvador, Mexico, Guatemala, to make it, and indeed Haiti, to make it so that people want to live there and not move to the U.S.? What should U.S. foreign policy be towards those countries?
Well, I think coming at crisis from not a point of national security, but coming at it at a point of not framing it within this is a place that poses a threat to us, acting not with lip service, but in a meaningful way to defend people's human rights. The fact is this country has taken action in other lands and under the guise of human rights issues. If that was the case, then they would be in Darfur, they would be in Myanmar, they would be in all Burma, all these other places where human rights violations are taking place. The U.S., any kind of human rights actions that they've talked about with respect to foreign policy have been lip service largely. And the things that we've done, like cutting funding for desperately needed food and supplies in Gaza, for instance, that have left people there struggling, you know, for food when so much of the population depended on it. Doing things like that takes away any kind of lip service that the U.S. has paid to doing anything regarding human rights. I would say there are a number of things that we could do. There are a number of ways we could use money instead of militarism. We could use that money to aid people who need food, who need access to medical care. If we do things like that, rather than framing situations within, you know, it's a national security crisis for us rather than a humanitarian crisis, then we can start having real meaningful conversations and quick action as a follow-up to reduce these, you know, the sufferings in other countries.
I'm sorry to say we're almost out of time. Anna Maria, if people are concerned about violence on the border by U.S. border guards, mm-hmm. What's the best website that people can go to, and when is your next protest?
Okay, we're having our next protest on the 10th of January. I think it's a Thursday, and it'll start at 3:00, and we'll be there until 7, so that we can get the people when they walk out from the office. And also, you can look at our Border Patrol Victims Network Facebook page. A good place to look at victims of Border Patrol abuses would be the Southern Border Coalition. You look also at Desiree Love Has No Borders and Occupy ICE Tampa. And let's see, I think those are good places to start here.
Protest on the 10th is again at the same spot in Ybor City?
It's going to be at the same place.
1624 East 7th Avenue.
Yes. Anna Maria Vasquez and Desiree Lynn, thank you so much for coming by WMNF.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
I didn't get around to the other topics I was going to do, but it's good to have you here. I'm glad you were able to stay for the whole hour. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Bill Grace has been our phone engineer. This is WMNF in Tampa.
One question I'd ask if I dared, of the ones whom we never see, and guns and dollars are voices for you, but who speaks for me? We are never asked, we are simply shown to the field.